is brought to you by the Jonas Podcasting Network, found exclusively at WrestlingWithJonas.com. Hello and welcome to the latest live episode of Wrestling with Jonas, episode 363. And today I've got a fabulous guest. You can see him on the right-hand side of the screen there on a very warm Friday evening. But you might be more familiar with my guest from hit TV shows such as Bad Education, Afterlife, Horrible Histories. But more recently, you may well have seen him inside of a wrestling ring over at CXW in Braintree, Essex. But I've got none other than Ethan Lawrence joining me on Wrestling with Jonas. Ethan, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm very well. I misjudged when the video was going to end, so that I was still dancing when we came back in.
We saw dancing is allowed. It's absolutely fine. I always tell my guests, swearing is fine, but dancing is absolutely a necessity. So if you feel like breaking out into a bit of a dance, then please do so.
But only when the right music comes up, Jonas. Only when the right music comes. I mean, I can't be forced into a waltz.
I don't know. I've seen kind of how flexible you are in your acting styles. I'm sure you can break out a bit of a dance move every so often, Ethan. But
I'm famously anti-dance, which is bad for someone who takes part in a show which features a lot of musical numbers, where I'm required by contract to shake that booty.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But in a children's sketch focused way, obviously, not like erotic booty shaking.
But of course we are live, and we're live on X, Facebook, YouTube and Twitch. So if you're watching us live, thank you so much for tuning in, but get in touch with the show, be part of the conversation, as they say. And if you want to send any questions or comments through for Ethan Lawrence, then now is your chance. Please get in touch with the show using your chosen device, and during the course of this interview I'll do our very best to answer every single question. But before we get into my questions, a quick picture of, more well-known for being an actor on TV and the big screen, but this picture here, there you are, yes. Of Danielle, former CXW Extreme Champion. We'll talk more about that a bit later.
Easy with the former, like, come on.
We'll talk more about that later, Ethan, because I want to get into the wrestling segment a bit later.
You've started this interview badly by putting me in a foul humour. So,
for any of your followers that know you from your TV shows, they might not be too familiar that you're now involved in this big wide world of pro wrestling, which we will take a deep dive into very, very soon. But Ethan, tell us a little bit about some of your projects, what you're up to at the moment. I understand that you're still very much part of Horrible Histories. You've been part of that now for a good couple of years, airing every Friday, of course. But a very kind of beloved, almost a British institution on our TV sets, and has been for many years. But tell us a little bit about still being a part of Horrible Histories.
Well, first of all, it's worthwhile pointing out that while it looks like I'm busy, I'm not. So if you're a casting director, hi, I'm free. The industry's in a bit of a state at the moment, but that's a conversation for another time. Horrible Histories. So the story I tell, because it is completely true, I secured my role in Horrible Histories on the 20th of March, 2020. Now, I don't know if you remember this, John. Is a couple of days after that, there was this, novel coronavirus.
A pandemic, yeah. Something like that.
That got put on the back burner for just a little while. So come May 2021, I'm not even joking, like 14 months later, we managed to mount it, and I am now part of Horrible Histories. It's storied history, which is incredible for me, because like I'm of an age where the books were a really formative part of my childhood, and I grew up reading them, and like then now to be part of this is like, oh, it's the sort of stuff you dream of when you become an actor, like, you know, being part of something like that. We continue apace. I did that series, which was series 9. And then at the back end of 2022, we did two series back to back, because obviously we lost the year due to the novel coronavirus, if you remember that.
And all too well.
And, so now, like, they're coming out sort of bits and squirts. Like, you know, occasionally there might be a chunk of episodes here. In the beginning, we were sort of hitting like date targets So we had one to coincide with the Women's World Cup. We had one to commemorate 75 years of the NHS. And we did one for the Tower of London as well, which is all good. And yeah, as you say, every Friday now they're trickling out. And that will keep everyone satisfied until we assume either 2026 or the heat death of the universe, whichever comes first.
And I mean, I'll check in kind of IMDb, doing my research. I always couldn't believe that it's only been around for 15 years. Now, you know, to a lot of people, 15 years might be a long time, but it may be because of the books, and the books have been around forever. But I honestly thought the Horrible Histories have been around for a lot longer than 15 years. And I mean, was it a TV show that you kind of, you mentioned about the books, but was it a TV show that you grew up watching as well, Ethan?
I just aged out of children's programming by the time it started. So that wasn't quite part of where I was at the time, because like, you know, I was in secondary school, I was a grown up, I didn't need this sort of stuff now. And so obviously it was nice then going back as an adult and being like, oh, this still bangs, like this still very much holds up. And oh, you know, it's again, like I say, what a thing to be a part of. And so often now, I mean, God bless him, I get maybe 3 or 4 messages a week reminding me that we'll never be as good as the original cast and we should just stop. But we're not going to stop. Sorry about that, because we're still winning BAFTAs, baby.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's described as a show that kind of teaches you about history that you won't learn in school. And it's a kind of very novel, very unique, very humorous look at kind of events from time gone by. But you've been part of it, as you said, for the last couple of years, filmed back-to-back series. But if you look at some of the fantastic comedians and actors, it really is a who's who, who's kind of been a part of that show over the years. I mean, you look at, you know, John Coleshaw, Simon Farnaby, Matthew Bainton, Katie Wicks, even Rowan Atkinson in an episode a while back. And I don't know if you've had a chance to star with or alongside any of those in Horrible Histories, but stepping on the Horrible History set with some of those names, it must be a thrill.
It really, really is. I did want to build on something that you said before, that like Horrible Histories deals with the stuff that schools won't touch. The irony is that the snake has now eaten its own tail, and Horrible Histories regularly gets shown in history classes in the schools.
Brilliant.
Because it's a way for getting the kids to like engage with it. Because like, you know, I'm sure both of us are from a time when learning history in school was just learning a succession of dates.
Whereas it's just World War II in my case. It was just World War II. That's all I remember from history.
But like kids especially are far more interested in like, you know, what was it like to go to the toilet in the Tudor era? Because that's what's actually interesting, that human element. And I think that's why it's had such staying power. But getting back to your question, I was lucky enough to meet the comedian Rosie Jones, who did a little guest spot for us. And I've been in scenes with Judge Rinder, of all people. Brilliant. And Fred Siriex from First Dates, because we do parodies of both of those shows. So like Judge Rinder does these sort of like court arbitration for historical beefs, as they call it. And First Dates with Fred Siriex, where it's structured exactly the same way as the show. But obviously he gets to stretch his comedy muscles. And he is darkly very funny. Like his reaction and timing is spot on. But then he's been doing it for a while. Like, you know, those types of sketches have been around for a fair old while now. And people come because they just love doing it. And you can sort of see why. Like, you know, it's because it is such an institution and because it is so much fun. Like, we've got people lining up the doors to come in and do stuff for us. Like, the football episode was hosted by Jill Scott. You know, just off all the big lionesses run, and it's like, hell yeah, you know, like we got some names over here. Absolutely. And then there's us lot, the ones in the mines doing the grunt work.
Well, let's bring up some pictures. You know, there you are, the gunpowder plot episode, few other characters of yours.
That's William the Conqueror's son there. some generic Pope, I think.
There we go. And
Je suis Napoleon.
What have been some of your favorite characters that you've played? Some of these episodes may not have aired yet, but talk about some of the characters that you can talk about that have been some of your favorites to play and why.
So the gunpowder plot one was a lot of fun. It was very interesting because I played Thomas Winter, who was one of the co-conspirators. And unusually for Horrible Histories, which usually sort of jumps around all different time periods, we specifically focused on the gunpowder plot in sort of like a kind of almost Peaky Blinders style arrangement, but with other stuff coming in. So that was a lot of fun to do. Some of the big hitters that I've been fortunate enough to play include Napoleon, as you showed. I was very lucky to play Winston Churchill, which, you know, for a fat white guy is like the big one. Charles the First has a lot of staying power because we did a lot of stuff about some of the early parts of the Revolution and the Reformation. And so there's a lot of Charles the First content out there for, you know, all the stuff that he went through. We had a big song where I did a parody of No Limits by Two Unlimited. And yeah, he's a lot of fun to play. Just this pompous, brash idiot. That had a lot of space to grow. It's nice when you're able to inhabit a character for longer than just one sketch. Like if they're across multiple sketches, that's the way to do it. But other times, like, you know, you're just playing like, you know, man or farmer or wherever it is, and you don't have huge amounts of time to sort of really get into who that guy is, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you said that the amount of episodes that you recorded 2 years ago that are now airing, I'll probably finish in 2025 or 2026. You know, is there an agreement in place? Will you be filming more episodes of Horrible Histories in the future? We'll be seeing you on our TV screens for a lot longer to come in that show.
Well, all I can say at this point is that they haven't officially kicked me out yet.
Good.
So what that means is, broadly speaking, were they to make more, I imagine I would be welcome unless something happens in between now and then. But we will see. You can never rely on anything in this little industry of mine, this life that I chose.
Absolutely. And we go from Horrible Histories, the TV show, to another recent project of yours that you just wrapped on. I think that's the term. But Silas, is that right? A horror film that you've just finished filming on. Tell us a little bit about that.
With Upstairs Productions, which was put together by, funnily enough, the script supervisor on Afterlife, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point, Philip Trowell. And he very kindly asked if I wanted to take part. And I did. So it's my first horror film. It's a short horror film. And the idea is eventually we'll shop it around the various festivals and such and see if we can't make a go of it of some description. But it's very interesting doing a horror for the first time. Very, very different, especially one like this that's quite quiet and quite muted. Because for the most part, it's just a conversation between two people sat opposite each other on a table. So it was very intense, lots of lines to learn and lots of fat monologues, which I don't usually get. And my big surprise going through it, because obviously Philip knew me through Afterlife, my big shock is that there wasn't a single joke in there. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, I can't, I haven't done serious. Acting since like secondary school. I can't do this. But you know, he put his faith in me, and hopefully when it comes out, people will like it. That is my hope.
Is there a proposed release date, Ethan? If so, will it be a cinematic release, or do you know how it's going to be distributed?
So this is not really my area of expertise. I've not really dealt with short films before. I believe the idea will be, it probably won't get as an exclusive cinematic release. What will probably happen is it will go around various short film festival circuits, and if someone likes it and is willing to distribute it, it might end up on a streaming platform at some point. The goal, as far as I'm aware, is to shoot for late summer when festival season really starts to kick up. So hopefully they'll be able to turn it around in the edit by then and then get it out. One of my big things is that whenever I'm in something, I plug it relentlessly and remorselessly. So when it does come out, anyone who follows me will know and will be actually genuinely sick of it by the time I finish plugging it. So later this year, hopefully we'll have more news in that regard.
Yeah. And a curious question from me, and obviously this, you described it as a short film and you've been in bad education and maybe one movies as well, but what would you say are some of the key differences for you in shooting a TV series as opposed to being on set for a feature film or a movie? What are some of the big differences for you that you might be able to explain to our audience?
Two of the films that I made were extensions of TV shows, so they were shot in very similar ways, so they didn't feel all that different. For the other two, I've been in four, by the way, maths fans at home, you might have been able to catch up with that. The other two had, like, one of them was a smaller scale project, but with American money behind it. That was How to Talk to Girls at Parties. And the other one was Magic Mike's Last Dance, which obviously had the cream of the crop floating around in there. And also I was there as well. And the big difference is scale. You know, when something like Magic Mike, when you've got so many moving parts and so many, like, various members of crew that you need, it's a much bigger crew, it's a much bigger performance space. So we were shooting in the Clapham Grand for the most part. Fans of wrestling will know it as the home of Riot Cabaret.
Riot Cabaret.
lovely place, beautiful theatre as well. And, like, to see the whole thing sort of, like, torn out and gutted and turned into a strip show was really quite something. It's something you don't really... It's one of those things with this job, when you sort of turn up to a place and it's been changed into what it's supposed to be, and you think to yourself, God, it's different every day, this job, isn't it? Here we are in the Clapham Grand, and we're doing a big old strip show, and I've just got to sit there and check out all the hunky boys, because that's my job in this. I've just got to watch.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Thank you for answering that. But for all the wrestling fans that have tuned in, now comes the wrestling portion of the interview. And I'm sure Ethan would be thrilled to take a deep dive here. But now we're going to be talking about Joe from Bad Education and James from Afterlife very, very soon. But I think the most recent time I've seen you, probably the only real time I've seen you in the flesh, was in Braintree, Essex for CXW, when I awkwardly introduced myself to you while we were both queuing up for hot dogs and hamburgers. But and they were free as well, so we weren't going to say no, were we, to be honest with you?
Of course not. I mean, we had a long evening ahead of us.
Absolutely. Need to get our sustenance in there. But how did you first get involved with CXW? And we'll talk about kind of, you know, all the key plot points of what's happened over the shows that you've been involved in, but I'm guessing Paris maybe reached out to you. But how was that first conversation? How did that first conversation go?
Quite the opposite. It was genuinely the other way around. So it, funny enough, it came through podcasting. So shout out to the Chew the Fat boys. If you're into your Witten based wittering podcasts, get involved. But because they're local to me, because I'm Essex also, I've been on their podcast a couple of times, and, like, you know, we'd become firm friends. And it turns out one of the hosts on that knew Adam Paris, who's the founder and CEO of CXW, Championship Extreme Wrestling.
And an all-round good guy. Stand-up guy.
Although, absolutely, I do have my issues with him, and we'll get to that. But he was on the podcast, and he very kindly said, well, why don't you come on down to one of our shows? So this was, I think, in November of last year. This was the Hawksmoor show that they did near Southend, and we watched it. Great show, brilliant show. Lovely stuff. We saw Leo Darwin win his championship there through some subterfuge, as you might expect. We saw that, and I got chatting to Paris afterwards, and I was like, look, you know, I'm a jobbing actor who has some renown. Like, if my involvement with CXW, as even just as an ambassador or something like that, can put one bum in one seat, then it's probably worth it, right? And he agreed, and so we started talking about what we could possibly do, which brings us to the show that we did at the end of March. This was the one where I met you, of course. Massive, there I am. I was brought in to do a ring announcement for one particular match. And things happened from there. Yes, a lot of things happened.
It did. We will get into that, Ethan. We will get into that. But I want to take you back to November. And while kind of scouring through your social media, Instagram, I come across a clip of the outlaw, Tim Strange, slapping you across the chest. So I think they call it a knife edge chop in the biz. And I've got some stills here. As contact is made there, Ethan,
yeah,
as contact is made, and then the look on your face after contact is made. Now, I don't know what you did to piss him off, but I could see that your friends that you went to the show with also had their tops off. I'm guessing they were getting chopped.
That's the Chew the Fat boys. And sort of the agreement was sort of like, in order to make content for the pod, we'd all agreed that we were gonna get chopped, and so inevitably, Paris, being the stand-up guy that he is, prick, selected big Tim Strange, who is, as you can see from the picture, a very large cowboy.
He's every bit of 6'4" and every bit of 20 stone, you know, and then some.
And he's got some momentum behind him. God love him. And of course, inevitably, when that happened, some of the other wrestlers who were nearby took notice. So that wasn't the only chop I received that night. I still owe a receipt to Sunset Skip, who really went for it, I thought. That was the one that knocked me backwards into the wall. You see behind me there. So that was, you know, it was all supposed to be a bit of fun. I'd never received a chop before, and they really hurt. I don't know if you've had one.
No, I've had some wrestling moves performed on me, but not quite as heavy-handed as a big Tim Strange or a Sunset Skip chop to the chest. And
it's a real
thump.
Real concussive thump.
A lot of them leave kind of, you know, handprints on your chest for days, or certainly what I've seen in the wrestling business. But for yourself, were you suffering for hours, if not days afterwards?
Weirdly, the pain subsided quite quickly. Like, you know, the sharp stinging pain that you get from that subsided quite quickly for me, at least. I know it wasn't the same for some of the other Chew the Fat boys. I think it's because largely I've got a sort of protective padding, which I'm going to refer to now as blubber. So that helped. But yeah, the marks didn't go for like maybe 3 or 4 days afterwards. Lee, who runs the podcast itself, Chew the Fat, he had it much worse. I think he managed to pop a blood vessel, I think, because he was like purple. By the time we got to the end of all that, it was, you know, some people out there are like, oh, wrestling isn't real. No, when you get chopped, it's pretty damn real.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
There's no way to do that without just sort of doing it, I guess.
Yeah. I think that sound of them chopped still reverberating around that venue as we speak. But I would have been suffering for days, if not weeks afterwards. But let's skip to March the 30th then. And it was the show, the aforementioned show in Braintree, Essex. I think they called it Be a Sausage Massive or something like that. A great name.
It's massive, and we celebrate with beer, sausage and wrestling.
100%. It doesn't get any better than that.
I announced there. We have the extreme champion, Joey Naylor, assisted by Samuel Bloody Wakefield. Sassy Bear Clarence and Rudy Roots, and that was my job to introduce that match.
Absolutely. You also made your presence known during that match as well, and I mean it was an extreme or a sassy street fight. It did get a little bit extreme. Of course, it was for the Extreme Championship. They did bring out all the toys, even an ironing board, and definitely that's bringing back some memories of the thumbtacks as well. And you went out there and you actually won the championship, all very briefly, cut an awesome
fair
promo.
And square as well. I won it absolutely fair and square.
Cut an awesome promo after winning your championship to the 500 plus people in attendance. And then you rather rudely got rolled up to lose your championship. I'm not going to say record time, but it probably was record time.
This is the narrative. This is the narrative that has been put out, right? We need to nip this in the bud right now. Because it's not just you. I don't blame you. Because if you watch any of the Championship Extreme Wrestling material that occurred afterwards, they're very keen to paint the picture that I was the shortest reigning champion. But let's get one thing straight, okay? I won that belt fair and square off of Sassy Bear Clarence. I held that belt while doing that promo for 1 minute and 58 seconds. You can't tell me I didn't. I timed it. Rudy Roo then, let's call it what it is, cheated. Sneaking up behind me and getting physical with a non-wrestler, and everyone's all cheering him like he's a big hero or whatever, but let's be honest, he assaulted a celebrity. So he rolls me up, and then what happens then? Oh, he gets speared through an ironing board by Joey Naylor and drops the belt in 19 seconds, which again, for the mass fans at home, is not as long as 1 minute and 58 seconds.
You make a good point.
But if you go on any of those, socials, all you will see is, oh, the shortest reigning champion of all time. No, I am being disrespected by CXW after all I've done for them.
There we go. And as the infamous Scott Steiner promo once said, the numbers do not lie. But I want to bring you back to this photo here. And I mentioned the thumbtacks and all the toys and gimmicks in the ring there. You were being rolled up into a bed of thumbtacks. Now, I've got to say, you didn't sell it, my friend, but I wouldn't have been keen to have been rolled up or to be anywhere near that ring full of thumbtacks. What was that like to be rolled up in those conditions?
Well, I think we need to be absolutely clear here. If you look quite closely at the photo there, you will see that I've managed to deftly avoid the main body of the thumbtacks using my cat-like reflexes and otherworldly dexterity.
Your ring awareness.
Yeah, that's what they call it. And, like, you know, that comes from stagecraft, really. That comes from treading the boards in my youth. I've got a kind of sort of preternatural awareness of where things are. And so I thought to myself, do you know what? I'm going to stay away from the tacks. And I did. I mean, they were in my shoes, but, you know, you can't really avoid that.
Yeah, I'm amazed that you avoided, you know, even one thumbtack. My luck would have been, I would have been right in the thick of it, but right in the bed of nails. And then afterwards, you cut this incredible promo. You were rudely kind of interrupted by one or two of the other assailants, but let's just cast our minds back to the post-match backstage interview. Here we go. I'm backstage here at CXW. I'm joined by Ethan Lawrence, very briefly, the CXW Extreme Champion. Any words? Any words for the public at home?
I've got nothing to say to the public, okay? I have got nothing to say to any of you, but I have got something to say to Rudy Root. You think you're such a big guy having to cheat to be a non-wrestler? Bravo, Rudy! But you know what? You are stronger than me. You are physically stronger.
Hey, but I think you want to clear out of here, son.
Yeah.
Mr. Champs here. Hit the bricks, kid. I told you. We told all
we
of you.
We gotta go. They come in. They
still
go.
Champs. We gotta still go. Champs. Screw you guys.
Come here, you scumbags. This ain't over, Joey. This is the last time you're gonna see it, mate. CXW. I want another shot for that belt. And this time, I want to make sure it's one-on-one.
Main event's back. Right. Rudy, like I was saying, okay? I am stronger mentally than you. I might not be able to beat you in a fair fight. But that doesn't mean it has to be fair. You call yourself the retro dude, keep doing it. Because you're going to be history.
There we go. Strong words. Strong words. Does that take you back to a couple of months ago, March, in Braintree? And have you got any other words for Rudy Root while we've got you?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say that when I cut the promo in the ring, I was quite rude to the audience. And, you know, I trumpeted myself up quite a lot. I may have uttered the words, I've conquered the world of television and cinema and children's sketch, and now I'm here to conquer the world of wrestling, which I understand is self-aggrandizing. So to the people that saw me cut that promo that evening, I meant every single word of it. You people are nothing to me. So I just want that be clear and on the record. Rudy Root. Rudy Root. Here's the thing. As I said in the interview there, I know that I'm unlikely to be able to beat him in a fair fight because I'm not a wrestler. You know, I'm a lover, not a fighter. And on the day, yeah, I took advantage of a situation that was there. And could Rudy beat me, you know, one-on-one in the ring? Absolutely. Of course, I've got no doubt about that. You know, he's a veteran and he's very good at what he does. You know, I would never say that the man is not talented. But I don't think he's quite ready for me. I don't think he's quite realized the can of worms that he has opened. And so, Rudy Root, I've said it to you before and I'll say it to you again. Keep your head on a swivel, bud, because we've got another show coming up. And, you know, things happen, don't they? Backstage, in the ring, things happen. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. Just be careful. But then, on the other hand, I've got to think to myself, if all of my achievements that I've had so far in wrestling, champion, basically undefeated, clean, like, you know, I had to cheat to win. So, okay, what's that hand gesture?
No, please carry on.
I'll just, you know, watch it.
We'll skip over that.
We'll skip over that. I've achieved so much in so little time, and yet already history is being rewritten before our eyes. Like, I'm being disappeared from the history books and forced now to be remembered as CXW's shortest reigning champion, which I'm literally not. And so I do have to question, is it worth me risking my neck? I don't know. Maybe I need to think of something else. Maybe I need to think of another way to punish not only Rudy Root, but the Stalin of professional wrestling, Adam Parrish. The man who is trying to erase all of my achievements. I've been thinking about it for a long while, and I'll just let people know, if you are in the Braintree area on June the 1st for Bangers and Smash, come along, because things are going to change in CXW very soon. I'm bringing a certain level of prestige.
Very interesting. Of course, you're referring to this June the 1st, Bangers and Smash CXW from the Braintree Sports and Health Club. And it's been announced across all of CXW's socials that you'll be the special guest commentator. Tell us a little bit about your involvement as a commentator. I'm guessing that's a career first for you as well, Ethan.
Very much a career first, but like, you know, much like my wrestling career also, I don't need to be experienced in something to smash it out of the park for the first time. And I'm quite certain that the commentary booth with young Matt, I'm sure he's going to be very grateful to have someone of my skill and gravitas helping him along on the day. For the people watching at home, obviously live on the day, that people aren't going to hear the commentary, but for the people watching along at home, preemptively, you're welcome.
There we go. And I want to ask you, kind of drawing parallels between your acting career and professional wrestling. And we talk about your professional wrestling fandom very, very soon, but drawing parallels between the two. And obviously, as you explained, when you went out there before your audience in Braintree, you cut a fantastic promo. You even won the match. You cut another awesome interview with me backstage. It looked like you were having a lot of fun, kind of all gripes aside. But tell us a bit about the parallels between acting and pro wrestling, and certainly your involvement so far, and where you draw the parallels between the two, Ethan.
Well, I mean, essentially, pro wrestling is Shakespeare with chair shots. I've always said that. That's something that I've always believed. And in order to succeed, not only in the acting industry but also in the wrestling industry, physical skill will only get you so far. It's all about big personalities. That's something that drew me to wrestling when I was younger, and it's something that draws me to wrestling now. I love the idea of larger-than-life people, sharing their thoughts and then sharing their bodies and everything like that. It's an incredible thing. It's gladiatorial combat. As I say, it's Shakespeare. It's pantomime. It's opera. It's soap. It's the distillation of all the finest forms of entertainment that you can have. And pretty reasonable ticket price also.
Absolutely. Yeah, so you can't beat it. Especially get yourself down to the Braintree Sports and Health Club June the 1st for Bangers and Smash, and you'll see Ethan there. You might even see me there wandering around with my blue cap. Come and say hi.
If you're not in Essex and you can't make it down to those shows, look into shows in your local area, because local wrestling always needs support, and it always needs fans, and it always needs an audience. And, I mean, you're not going to have a bad time.
No, and you always get good value for money. But as you said, couldn't have said it better myself. Supporting
brilliant family entertainment, really is
100%. Tell us a bit about your love for pro wrestling, because you alluded to it there. But I'm guessing you've been a lifelong wrestling fan, or certainly from an early age. But tell us about your wrestling fandom and what impact it had on you, maybe from a young age.
So early ish, I sort of started following it. This would have been. So it was, of course, the WWF, and then very soon after I started watching at the WWE. So this would have been around sort of late Attitude into Ruthless Aggression, sort of 2001, 2002, that sort of time.
Good time.
Great time to be a professional wrestling fan. I was there for the rise of Big Match Jonathan and all the stuff like that, SmackDown 6, all the greats, those good times. I started to sort of dribble off sort of, and as I went to university and sort of grew out of it, although you never really grow out of it, do you? But I watched it sort of less and less, and my final straw when I thought I was basically done with wrestling was the 2015 Royal Rumble. Now the Royal Rumble is my favorite stipulation of all time. It's just the best one. It's perfect, from everything, from its design to the way it can structure a story and everything like that. It's my absolute favorite. And the 2015 Rumble was just so foul, so putrid. And I just couldn't do it anymore. And I thought, I think I'm done with wrestling now. And so I put it down. I put it down for, well, until All Elite Wrestling, really. And I imagine the story is fairly similar for a few other people who had just become disillusioned and disenchanted with the WWE product and were just desperate for something new. And then AEW came along and it brought me back. And I remember why I fell in love with wrestling in the first place.
And what is it in particular about AEW that really kind of pulled you back in and gravitated towards you?
It's sort of the, I know this is such a non-answer, but it was kind of like, it was the intangibles in a lot of ways. Like the fact that it didn't feel so tightly scripted. It didn't feel like everything was a branding opportunity. And there were different styles of wrestling as well. Like, you know, say what you like about the WWE house style. A lot of people love it. It's not necessarily for me. But with, especially early AEW, maybe less so now as it sort of starts to coalesce into, you know, its own sort of identity.
Yeah.
But in the early days, you had all sorts going on there. You had Joshi, you had Lucha, you had, you know, straight up American style. You had Brawl. It was like, it felt like there was, it just had everything. And it felt like almost a, again, this sort of sounds almost dismissive, but almost like a variety show. You know, like a proper sort of old school indie variety show, but like on the telly and like selling out big arenas. And yeah, that's really what brought me back into it. And, you know, in a big way. And like, I've gone back now and like looked at some of the other stuff that I missed from recent WWE. Cause I mean, I was sort of intrigued because around the time of 2015, the Shield had imploded and I didn't really know what happened to those guys. Like I knew they were like putting everything on old big dog Roman Reigns' shoulders, but I wasn't really sure what had happened to Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose. And then suddenly, oh my gosh, John Moxley. I reckon, him off of the Shield. What's he doing here? So I was like, right, well, what happened to him? And that's a sad tale for another time. But I mean, for WWE now, I mean, if I needed another reason not to watch it, it would be the involvement of the Saudi government. You know, I can't feel I can put my hard earned money into that product. But I do still watch the Rumble because it's the best one, John. It's the best one.
Absolutely. It's my favorite pay per view of the year as well. And you was at Wembley last August for All In, I understand, and I was there as well. Thrilled to be there. And the last time I saw a wrestling show at Wembley was 31 years earlier, or 30 years earlier, for SummerSlam 92. I was there when it was the old Wembley Stadium. But 30 years later, All In, AEW, a fantastic crowd, a great show, a great spectacle.
Brilliant show.
You were there as well. Tell us about your All In experience from last August. And of course, they're revisiting and doing the same again this coming year. But
And I will be there as well.
Same. But yes, I will indeed.
Looking forward to it. I mean, God knows what we're going to get. But I mean, we are eating well in AEW right now. But yeah, I mean, All In was an absolutely incredible experience. I was not born when SummerSlam 92 happened. I was born just a few months afterwards. So I'd never experienced wrestling on that scale, live at least. And I suppose a lot of people had. And it just showed to me that, like, and I think WWE especially is starting to get it now, that there are other territories outside of, like, North America. And they are absolutely gagging for big shows. And, you know, it's unfortunate for WWE that AEW got there first, really. Because, I mean, could you imagine, like, a WrestleMania at Wembley? But, like, they're not going to be able to pop that particular cherry now, because now everyone will just be able to point to All In.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's business. That's what it is. But, like, to have put on a show at that scale and for everyone to be so into it. I mean, I imagine there were a fair few people there who either hadn't heard of or watched AEW at all, but they were just desperate to come and just watch some wrestling with 80,000 of their friends. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what an experience. Absolutely. Like, you know, as everyone was yelling and the chants, and like, you could feel it in your chest as, like, you know, all the boos came in and everything like that. And I mean, the matches themselves were incredible as well. I mean, what a card. I mean, you know, obviously marred a bit by the fact that was CM Punk's last appearance in AEW.
No, we didn't know at the time, but
didn't know, and it was a damn good match.
It was a damn good match. It was a damn good match.
Punk and Samoa Joe. I mean, but sign me up for that. Like,
absolutely, absolutely. We're going to move on from wrestling now, and it's a pleasure to speak to you about your wrestling fandom. But now, going through your IMDb list, I noticed that some of your first acting roles actually came about in 2012. So, what's that, 12 years ago now? But what first fascinated you or attracted you to want to be an actor? Did you do any plays at school or from a young age? What was kind of your, you know, that drew you into being an actor, or maybe your comedian chops?
So I didn't have much experience of it in primary school, because I've told this story on a million times, but my mom is a voracious reader, and so was I. So I had a pretty good reading level in comparison to some of my peers. And so inevitably, when the school play time rolled around, I was the narrator. You know, I was the one that stood at the side next to the old, you know, there's old music stands. It's got the script on it, and I'm just reading it out. So that's, I mean, it's acting in a way, but it's not really. But it was only when I got to secondary school and started studying it like as an actual thing in drama that I was like, oh, hello. And I mean, what drew me to it broadly was that I was good at it. And, you know, I found an aptitude for it quite early. Like, you know, I was a fairly decent student. Like, you know, I was pretty good grades across the board. But like, this was one where I felt I could not just like thrive, but absolutely excel at. And I'll be honest with you, I just became absolutely obsessed. I signed up for every school play. I started doing extracurricular ones outside of school. Like, I was doing, I was taking acting classes. I was taking singing lessons. I was doing musical theater. I was doing plays. Like, every time, basically all the time that I wasn't in school, I was doing acting. You know, obsessive is really the word that you would use. You know, I didn't have weekends for the longest time because I'd be rehearsing two shows across every weekend. It was just, it was mad. But all of it I felt was just getting more and more experience. And like the electricity that you felt when you're out on stage, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And that feeling when you can make an audience feel something, you know, be it laughter, be it tears. It's usually laughter in my case, because I'm not very good at dramatic acting. But I've sort of gone all starry-eyed and nostalgic now. Yeah. but then you landed
the role of Joe, didn't you?
In Jack Bence's magnificent arms.
But that would have been fairly early on into your professional acting career, I'm guessing. You would have been a teenager at the time?
The first professional thing I did.
Really? And how did you land that role? Tell us a bit about the origins of getting that role, sorry.
So I'd gone off to university. Now, important context before we get there was that So the amateur musical theatre company that I was with, they set up, I guess you'd call it sort of like a little cottage agency, because the big thing at the time, and it still is today to a certain extent, was to get on a casting website, namely Spotlight, which is the big one. And back then, it's probably a lot different now, but back then, all you needed to get on Spotlight, you didn't need any credits or anything, you just needed representation. And so that was the sort of loophole where it's like, oh yeah, we're an agency and we've got people on the book, so then we could get on Spotlight. But by the time like I was going off to university, that had sort of folded, but I still had a year left. I still had a year left on my Spotlight contract. And so I was like, right, well, I mean, there's no point taking it down. Like, you know, I'll just leave it up and see what happens. And lo and behold, in the second term of my first year, I get a call from Anne, who ran the agency, saying, they've asked if you want to audition for a thing. It's like this BBC Three project with Jack Whitehall. And I was like, yeah, I'll go. You know, at this point, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. Like, you know, I was studying drama and creative writing at university, but there was no plan. Like, there was no, like, I didn't know what to do. You know, I don't have anyone I know who works in the industry. Like, you know, I don't come from family that works in the industry. I was working it out on my own. But I go off to this audition and, you know, I didn't shave for it. Like, you know, going in for playing a schoolboy, I didn't shave for it. I didn't get my hair cut. I looked like an absolute mess. But they decided to take a punt on me, and they did. And then I think about maybe a month or two later, I was on my first ever professional TV shoot wondering what had happened.
Absolutely fantastic. And there he is again, Joe Poulter, isn't it? That's the guy's name. But we have to talk about some of the haircuts. And okay. First, that one there, the bowl cut, the infamous bowl cut. And then, of course, the skinhead. You went from one extreme to another.
My head got put through the ringer. Were they your styles
that you just had as a teenager at the time? Or was that kind of part of the script that you had to have a bowl haircut for this particular season? Tell us about the haircuts in particular, because I think they're just as famous as anything from that series.
Well, it was intended as a visual gag. Like, it was written into the script, and it was sort of like, are you okay with doing this? And I was like, I mean, I guess. Because if I say no, you'll just recast me. So...
Brilliant.
So, 7 weeks with the bowl cut, and 6 weeks getting trimmed down with the skinhead. With one episode where I wore an entire bowl cap, because obviously we kept it sort of like as a kind of sort of fuzzy, sort of almost down. And that was for 6 weeks after that as well. And then it took ages to grow back. I did one of the jobs that I did quite soon after, which was the Up All Night Friday download film. I'm wearing what is quite clearly a wig. And that's because underneath it, I am bald as a coot. So I couldn't quite get away with it. But, but since then, I mean, that's one thing I learned quite early on. And it's a good lesson to learn early on when you get into professional acting, which is that your appearance is really no longer yours. Like, you know, you adapt to whatever job you got at the minute. I mean, obviously, I've had a haircut and a shave now, but that's largely because, as I alluded to at the top of the episode, like, there's not really much going on in the industry at the minute. So I was like, well, why don't you just do something for you? You know, you don't do that very often. And so, yeah, I just had a bit of trim, but like, it is just a trim. Like, it's the same haircut. I don't change styles ever. Like, you know, I haven't had like a fade or anything, because you've got to sort of be ready to go at a moment's notice. And so to have a sort of like normal haircut is probably the best way to go.
So you won't be tempted to try any of these again then? The bowl cut, bring that back into fashion? I think it's,
if you knew how much work it took to get it to look like that and be camera ready, there's no way.
My friend, there must be so many products in there and a good amount of combing.
Genuinely, if memory serves, it took about half an hour to get it to that sort of bump and voluminousness. Absolutely. And that was every day, every damn day that was coming in. I'd be like, all right, we're doing this again, are we? All right, boof, boof, boof.
I only wish to have hair like that. But we've also got to talk about the movie as well, Bad Education, the movie, which I think was released in 2015, in the days when I was when I was working in the cinema business, certainly in the cinema industry. And let's say going from the TV series to the film, that's quite a big step up, and a lot of extra hours, a lot of extra work, a lot of extra importance as well. But that must have been a lot of fun and a thrill, especially at that age, to be part of a feature film. So, such as that.
Yeah, I mean, I had the Up All Night Friday download one was my first feature, so I'd had experience with sort of how that works. But again, that was adapted from a BBC television show, so like it's very, I mean, in this case, so the film and the second series share a director, Elliot Hegarty, good guy, watch his stuff, he's brilliant. And so broadly speaking, it wasn't really that much different. Like, we kept the same hours, and you know, it was structured almost like a TV show anyway, just like an almost extra long episode. So really the only difference was that we were in Cornwall and Wales for a bit. Wales doubling in for Cornwall, because apparently that looks more like Cornwall than Cornwall does. The magic of television, or cinema in this case. It wasn't ultimately that much different. It was you could sort of taste the slightly enhanced budget. You know, the fact that we were able to get some bigger names for some of the characters, because we had Joe Scanlon play my mum, and Ian Glenn off of the Game of Thrones to play the villain, and so there was more scope there. But like in other places, it really did felt quite similar, because like it was just like getting the old gang back together, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, 100%.
Except we're all on holiday.
I want to talk about this next and afterlife. And when I awkwardly introduced myself at the Burger Van a couple of months ago in Braintree, Essex, I said, Ethan, a massive fan of Afterlife. And all three series just had me in fits of laughter and floods of tears. And it was kind of one of them very, very, very special TV shows, and probably one of the best TV shows I think has been produced in the last 20 years, and possibly some of Ricky Gervais's finest work, considering everything he's done in his career. But yes. absolutely incredible. Now, I know that in series one, you were only involved in maybe one or two episodes. We were introduced to you as Recorder Boy, weren't we? And there
yeah,
we go.
Yeah, there he is.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to get out the recorders and to kind of...
Good, because I don't have any.
Live out.
I don't have any for this exact reason.
Playing the recorder, or playing a recorder through each nostril. Skipping back a little bit, tell us a little bit about how you first got involved with Afterlife.
So it was a very standard procedure for me. It was literally came through as an audition, you know, especially when times are good. Like, you know, I could be banging through two or three of those a week. So it was a case of, like, you know, not to be too dismissive of it, but it was like, oh, this is another one. Because like when I do with auditions, like you don't get them like 99.9% of the time. So like you can work as hard as you want, but you actually don't get the job. So eventually you become just a little bit jaded to it all. But I was like, oh right, Ricky Gervais, Netflix. All right, let's go do the do. Did the audition, got the part. A couple of weeks later, I was on the set. I was there for 90 minutes. Shot all my stuff and then went home. And I was like, right, well that was that then. That was good. You know, little did I know the sort of impact it would have, because I'd only read my bit. Like that was the only bit that I was sent. Yeah. So I was like, oh, that's quite funny. Fair enough. That's cool. And it wasn't until it came out and like the reaction started flooding in, I was like, oh, this is actually something quite special, isn't it? Jesus. I don't think anyone was anticipating that. But by this time, my career had fallen into one of its many slumps. One so severe at that point that I'd gone off to do pizza delivery, which I did for about a year. And in the interim between Afterlife, shooting that Afterlife and it coming out, I basically resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to be acting again. Because this is a job of momentum, essentially. So like once that momentum's gone, it's very, very hard to get it back again. And I was like, well, I didn't make enough of a splash, so I doubt anything's going to happen. Anywho, so I get the call from Ricky's people saying that he wants you to come back. And not only does he want you back, he wants you in all six episodes of series two. Wow. And I was like, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll do that. And that's how it happened. He rescued me from my potential future of slinging slice for the rest of my life.
Yeah, and what describe a typical day on set? Because, you know, going back to some of your other fantastic work, Horrible Histories and Bad Education, you're working with an incredible cast, a fantastic crew, great scripts. I can only assume that a thrill ride to be part of it. Describe a typical day and what it was like for you and some of your experiences on set.
So one of the big things about a Ricky Gervais set is that he likes to clock off early. So generally a shooting day, not including sort of like hair and makeup beforehand and rigging and everything like that, a standard shooting day will have cameras start rolling at 8 and wrap up at 7. That's generally your standard shooting day, especially for British telly. In his case, he likes to be done by 4. So we're trimming 3 hours off the day already, which is, you know, really quite extraordinary. And he does that through a combination of being the dude, because like he's not only the actor, but the writer and the director. So he's across most of the creative aspects of the show. And so he knows exactly what he wants. So when we come in, like the cameras will already be set up, and usually we cross shoot so that he can use the same track of dialogue. Everything is basically designed to be as efficient as possible, which then means that the time we save doing that allows us to clock off early, but also gives us an opportunity for us actors to have a bit of a play around. Generally that wasn't the case so much for me, because like eventually I ended up working with David Earl, who played Brian Gittins. And the thing with Brian Gittins as a character and David Earl as an actor is that all you need do to succeed is say nothing. Like you just got to sit there and watch him go. So that was broadly my job. Come in, say a couple of lines, and then just admire David Earl doing his thing. And that was my day.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I loved about Afterlife was it was a comedy. There was a lot of funny one-liners and a lot of sarcasm, but it was extremely poignant. And obviously, you know, the main topic was about life and death, and how he kind of dealt with life after, you know, he'd grieving for the death of his wife and the various trials and, you know, the the turbulence that he went through as a human being after the death of his wife. And I mean, you probably weren't involved in a lot of those poignant scenes. You were involved in more of the comedy scenes, from what I remember.
Yeah, but, I was basically there to keep the mood up.
Absolutely. but you know, that's exactly my point, is, you know, the script was a mixture of comedy and poignancy, and, you know, it had its light and dark to it. You know, as an actor, is that kind of an interesting type of set or environment to be a part of, when it's not kind of strictly comedy and it's not strictly, you know, poignant or dark, but you had that mixture, you had that balance, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, because, like, I think this is sort of, I don't know, maybe it's an illusion or something, but there's this sort of idea that, like, you know, when we're there, we're all very deep in the process and what am I doing here? But especially, unlike, it's true for this for most sets, but especially a Ricky Gervais set, everything's very light. And I think that was important, because when you're dealing with those sorts of subjects, and when you're, you know, trying to blend in those elements of comedy with those elements of pathos, you're treading a very, very fine line. And, you know, it can go either one or two ways, because if you put in too much drama, that negatively impacts the comedy and sort of makes it mawkish. Whereas if you sort of put too much comedy in, then the drama completely deadens its impact.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't work. And I think the only real way you can sort of maintain that balance is to just keep the set light. And so, like, you know, he posted up on both, I think it's on both the Netflix channels and also his personal YouTube. That's why there are so many bloopers. That's why there are so many outtakes, because it's just a fun place to be and an explorative place to be, like, you know, where we can muck around and maybe we'll find something funnier than that's actually in the script.
Yeah.
Because more often than not, like, you know, he casts people, you know, blowing smoke up my own ass here, but, like, he casts people because he knows that they're good at what they need to do. And so, like, he barely has to sort of direct. He doesn't need to be that hands-on, because he can go, right, well, you're you. You know what you're doing. You know what you represent. And so you could just go straight in. And so, yeah, it felt like it was a very freeing set. And I suppose in that way, that really helped with the way it was then presented. Because a fun set, you get a fun series, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, sometimes you can sort of sense, there's, like, if it was a tense set, you can sort of sense it when you're watching it. Like, you know, there's no way it can be hidden by the edit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been relatively lucky throughout my career that most of the sets that I've worked on have been absolutely lovely. Absolutely. And I think that tends to be the case, because it's all, you know, we're all professionals trying to make a thing here.
Yeah, totally. And I'm going to bring up a few more pictures. There you are as James in the newsroom, if I'm not mistaken. There you are.
Doing the West Side Story business. Lovely bit of business.
And there's me
and the boss man.
With the man himself, Ricky Gervais. And I want to talk about Boat Story. Now, that was a huge success on BBC last autumn. I think it aired around November, December time. And you were very much a part of that as PC Ben 2, I think I pronounced that right. And a bit more of a serious, I think a bit more of a drama this time, a bit more of a serious role for you, if I'm not mistaken. And a few pictures here of you on set filming. And like I say, Boat Story was critically acclaimed, did very, very well. And it was great, you know, conversation the following day, you know, around the water cooler, as they say. But a fascinating plot, a great series. You were a part of it. Once again, you know, how did you get involved? Again, maybe a slightly different role to any of your previous roles.
Well, I'm going to shock you once again and tell you that it was an audition. that's how I get all my roles. But this audition came at a very interesting time, because this was while I was shooting Horrible Histories.
Right.
And so, like, we'd put Aurora in and said, you know, we'll see what happens. But, like, there was a real risk that even if I was offered the part, like, I wouldn't be able to do it, because I was already under contract with Horrible Histories. But it turns out they did want me, and they really wanted me. Like, they were willing to fight tooth and nail to get me on that set. And so I was largely kept free of all this, because I was busy doing the Horrible History stuff, and we were doing the Bad Education reunion at the same time. This was very busy. I was a very busy boy, late 2022. So I was largely shielded from what was happening behind the scenes. But it turns out there were like multiple, like three-way arguments between the producers of Horrible Histories, the producers of Boat Story, and my agent, as they're all sort of trying to hash this thing out and like try and make it so that it could work. In the end, I was able to negotiate losing a week on Horrible Histories to then go shoot Boat Story. And so then it ended up being kind of really jarring, because I would do a day on Horrible Histories where we, you know, we'd come in and we'd shoot a load of comedy sketches, and I'd be covered in glue and hair and everything like that. And then we wrap that up at 7. Then I'd hop on a train, because we were shooting at the West London Studios at that point, which is out near Heathrow. I'd hop on the, at the time, brand new Elizabeth line, get myself into central London, hop on a train up to Leeds, get to Leeds, learn my lines for Boat Story the next day, then crash out in a hotel, wake up at like 5 in the morning, go and do Boat Story all day, wrap at 7, get back on the train, come back down to London and then out to Heathrow, learn all my lines for Horrible Histories, pass out. It was very busy.
Wow.
And so tonally, the two were so utterly and completely different.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, Horrible Histories, while it is a lot of fun and knockabout and everything like that, it is also very tightly script supervised, because we have to get all the history right. So, you know, as fun as it is, it has to be accurate. It has to be, you know, it has to be proper, as they say. And then with Boat Story, like heading up there, even though it was a sort of more dramatic role, I was still basically operating in the kind of comic relief sphere. Like one of the pictures that you put up when I'm talking to your man in the waiting room. Yeah, that's the one. That scene is hilarious, because I'm like trying to help him get over the death of his partner, and constantly putting my foot in it by saying stupid stuff. That's Ben 2's whole thing. He can't let a silence be. He has to just fill it. And that ends up costing him dearly later down the line, as he tries to solve the mystery himself. It was a fun little thing. And while it was comedy for the most part, I was given the opportunity to do a little bit of real acting, as I like to call it, like not the knockabout bollocks that I do, but like some actual stuff that I used to do back in my teens, like, you know, when I was doing Shakespeare and Moliere and all this. You know, real acting, yeah, the Chekhov, Stanislavski, the method. And it reawoke something in me, where I was sort of like, oh yeah, you know what, I could still do that. And it made me feel more confident that I could take those roles on in the future. But I mean, you know, I've said this before a few times as well, a lot of people ask me sort of like saying, oh, do you want to focus on more dramatic roles now, or do you want to do more drama stuff? And my answer always is, I'll do what pays. Like, you know, I'm not anywhere close in my career to have the ability to turn work down. So I take what's offered. And it just so happens that because I've established myself so firmly as a comedy guy, that I tend to get offered comedies, which is fine by me. Like, you know, I'm making it sound like this is like an, oh, woe is me. It's really not. Like, you know, I've made a pretty comfortable living out of being a comedy guy. So that's not a problem for me. But yeah, it would be nice to reawaken that, and we spoke about it earlier with old Silas as well, about it not having a single joke in there. And so again, really having the opportunity to go, right, well, how am I going to play this, because I can't just dump a punchline, which is, you know, I could do that with my eyes closed these days, but actually doing acting, doing it properly. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm selling myself short, I don't know. But either way,
I think what it does demonstrate is your flexibility as an actor. You're very adaptable, and you can play serious or comedy, you know, whatever is asked of you. And I don't think every actor can kind of say they can do that.
I think comedy actors maybe find it a little bit easier to go into drama rather than dramatic actors going into comedy. Not to say that there can't be that crossover. I mean, there's been, you know, plenty of examples, that too many to even mention. But I think because, I mean, I've spoken to some dramatic actors that are sort of like, you know, I don't know how you do it. And it's like, I find that extraordinary, because I'm like, but you're a really good actor though. Like, you know, why are you struggling with this? Why would this be a struggle? And I don't know, maybe there's just something more elemental about comedy that's just different in the way it's timed and different in the rhythms or something like that. I don't even know what it is, because, you know, I'm blowing smoke up my own ass, but because it sort of comes naturally to me at this point, I can't really put my finger on what it is. So I don't know. Maybe that's just something ephemeral going on that I don't know about.
Let me ask you, and as we start to kind of wind up this episode of Wrestling with John, is, and it looks like you've covered a lot of roles, a lot of different shows over the years. But what are some of your proudest accomplishments and achievements within your acting career, or possibly the wrestling world, over the last 12 or 13 years?
One of the big ones for me came just after things started to open up around the tail end of the pandemic. Because I mentioned earlier, and we've sort of almost made a joke of it, the fact that, like, whenever you ask, how did you get that role? My answer is usually auditioned for it. But there has been three cases now in my career where I've been given what they call an offer only, which is where they ask for you specifically, no audition. And when that happens, there is a little part of you that, because, I mean, so much of being an actor is, like, you know, self-defeating. Like, you know, I'd had, like, imposter syndrome and all kinds of things for just the vast bulk of my career. Like, it took me, I'd say, nearly 10 and 11 years of being a professional actor to actually allow myself to say, I'm good at acting. Which is, like, it's stupid, I know. But when that happens and someone goes, we want you, and you don't have to audition, you're like, I've made it, haven't I? Like, you know, I'm now I'm a respected person in my chosen field. Because suddenly you're now thinking of yourself like, okay, right. Yeah. They wanted me. I didn't have to beg. And so that happened, as I said, it's happened now three times. The first one was Murder, They Hope, which was a comedy sort of detective procedural with Johnny Vegas and Sean Gibson. And the other one, weirdly enough, was Magic Mike, of all things. And both of those came off of the back of Afterlife.
Brilliant.
So I can, you know, I can thank Afterlife for that as well. It's basically given me, if you think about it, essentially the second half of my career. You know, if you consider sort of like the Bad Education years up to Pizza Delivery to be the first half. So that takes you from 2012 through to 2018. And then Afterlife onwards, 2019 through to now. Yeah, this is sort of the second chapter of my career. And hopefully we're going to start a third soon. As soon as everyone can pull their finger out and start making stuff again.
Absolutely. But let me ask you this fun question to wrap up this episode of Wrestling with Jonas. And we brought up this picture earlier. Recorder Boy, your first episode in series one of Afterlife, of course. And that was the series, that was the program that gave you several kind of opportunities and breaks afterwards. But did you have to practice a lot to be able to play the recorder one through each nostril? How much time and effort did you have to put into that?
I'm going to ruin a lot of people's dreams here.
You didn't do it.
Right, okay. Before you start accusing me of things, right, let me explain what happened. So, we knew going into it, and I had been told, and that was absolutely fine, we knew that it was going to be put in post. Simply because we couldn't guarantee that I'd be able to get it perfect on the day. Now, bear in mind on this that, like, you know, I was a day player. Like, you know, I wasn't someone that Ricky Gervais was familiar with at the time. I was just a guy who was going to come and do this and then leave. So they didn't need to invest any time in me, really. But for my own sense of professionalism, knowing that in the script it was like playing London's Burning, I learned the fingering so that when I could do it on screen, it would at least look right. And then the rest of it was just acting and then post in the edit. And that's how a lot of TV is made. Ladies and gentlemen, it's all smoke and mirrors and lies.
Would never have guessed.
Not like wrestling, which is super duper real.
Absolutely. But
no smoke and mirrors there, no sir.
Ethan Lawrence, we look forward to seeing you Bangers and Smash June 1st from the Braintree Sports and Leisure Hall. Leisure Club, Braintree, Essex. Wish you continued luck and success in your acting career, Horrible Histories and all that good stuff. Keep up the awesome work. But if you've got any final words to sign us off this episode of Wrestling with Jonas, from Ethan Lawrence, star of Stage, Screen, and so much more, Wrestling Ring, Thumbtacks, and all that. He's a great survivor of thumbtacks, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, as he explained
very dexterous.
But if you've got any final words to sign us off this episode of Wrestling with Jonas, what would they be?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure to be interviewed by you on the day, even though at the time I was in a bit of a sulk, I'll be honest.
You're a bit flustered, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then there's people pushing me out of the way, and Samuel Bloody Wakefield, and we'll get to him at some point. But, you know, I very much appreciate you taking your time to interview me and then to ask me on to do the podcast. So thank you very, very much for that.
You're welcome.
And broadly speaking, my advice to any young actors out there is the same advice that I always give, which is, unless you are 100% convinced that this is what you want to do, don't try, because it's not worth it. Like, unless you breathe acting, unless you literally cannot think of yourself doing anything else, give it up, soldier, because it's far too tough out there, and there just aren't enough parts for you to get. And if you're not committed, you ain't gonna make it. So just give up on that dream and leave it to people like me, idiots. I mean by that when I say that.
Ethan Lawrence, you've been an awesome guest, and we'll see you in Braintree in a few weeks' time. But thank you so much.
Thank you.